Hello, and welcome to another episode of Untied Methodism, where we unravel the past to make sense of today. I am your host, Dr. Ashley Bogan, the General Secretary of the General Commission on Archives and History. And we are continuing our historic look at Methodist women as we celebrate 70 years of women's full conference membership and the right to ordination. Joining me today is Sally Bonner. Sally Bonner is the General Secretary of United Women in Faith, where she leads the implementation of the organization's vision, mission, and strategic plan to support women, children, and youth around the world. She's a longtime United Methodist leader and has served in roles ranging from women's retreat leadership to jurisdictional conference delegation, as well as in ministries focused on immigration, community development, and dismantling racism. She holds a Master of Divinity and Women's Studies certificate from SMU Perkins School of Theology and a bachelor's degree in biology from East Texas State University. She also serves on the board of the Skerritt Bennett Center in Nashville. We also have joining us Tara Barnes. Tara is a return guest to Untied Methodism. Tara is the Director of Denominational Relations for the United Women in Faith, helping members understand the United Methodist Church so that women's voices can be heard in the church's decision-making spaces. She previously served as an editor of United Women in Faith's magazine, Response, for 12 years. She graduated from Allegheny College and worked in publishing before a fateful Sunday at church brought her to United Women in Faith. A lifelong United Methodist, she is the chair of her church's Staff Parish Relations Committee, Binghamton District Lay Leader, Vice Chair of the Upper New York Conference on Nominations and Leadership Development, and member of the Upper New York Commission on Archives and History. She serves on the board of the Broome County Council of Churches and will be consecrated a deaconess in May 2026. Tara and Sally, thank you both for being here.
Thank you for having us. Great.
Yes. So last time, or in our last episode, we chatted with Dr. Ellen Blue, and she told us about the wonderful ministries of deaconesses kind of in the late 19th, kind of early 20th century. And one of the things I want to make sure our viewers know is that, one, deaconesses are still around, and two, the work and the mission and the ministry that they began kind of in those movements of the turn of the 20th century continued throughout the 20th century and continue today. So to start us off, can you kind of tell us, how does United Women in Faith fit in with deaconesses? Sally, you want to take that one?
I'm going to let Tara. She's about to be consecrated as a deaconess, so I'm going to let her speak and I'll add to as we talk.
Awesome.
It's only fair, right? In just a little over a month, I get to join that lay order in the church. Like you said, we are still here. In 2016, it became an official order, so we're very much still here. So officially right now, we are the administrator of the Office of Deaconess and Home Missioner. So this lay order is a part of United Women in Faith, the organization. And it's right. It's another path for laity to serve the church, which is a wonderful thing, even if sometimes confusing. Right. Wait, we have lay ministers. We have lay servant ministries. We have deacons. Deaconess is a historic order and fought long and hard for the women's organization to be the administrators of it. That was its current home. That ended up being the right place for it. It was one time administered by the general board, or the annual conferences sort of made it a role for them to commission. But today it is part of United Women in Faith. And we have our wonderful colleagues, Scott and Megan, who help recruit and help train us and educate us, keep us connected in this covenant community. So that's, and United Women in Faith helps pay for the theological education we receive, which is pretty amazing. If you're a deaconess or home missioner candidate, that's the word I'm looking for, you get high-level seminary education that is paid for by United Women in Faith. You got to get yourself to the class, but they're offered online as well. So in addition to being the administrators, we also are helping nurture and encourage folks to not only discern this call, but then if they've found this is a role for them, helping support them in getting the training and support that they need. And so lay ministry, right? That's in many different forms. How deaconesses and home missioners see it is like beyond the walls of the church, a lifetime commitment to the United Methodist Church with the requirement to be a member of a United Methodist Church and right, a fruitful contributor to your local work. But then taking our church beyond the walls of the physical building. We have nurses, which is historic, right? We have social workers, which is one of the fun things to say is that deaconesses were really sort of the very first social workers in the United States. But in this weird, and I bet Dr. Blue talked about this, where it was religious order, so maybe not taken as seriously as it should have been because it was religious women, right? But who were doing the very same work as their secular sisters in social work. We have firefighters. We have folks like me who work for the church officially, either as an agency staff or in a local church doing music therapy. Or we have social workers, right? We have folks who are working for outreach organizations and advocacy groups. So it's a place for those of us who feel very much called to be committed to the United Methodist Church for our lives, but absolutely do not feel called to ordained ministry. And hopefully that did answer at least part of your question.
It did. Good. Doing the process of becoming a deaconess is one of those that I long to do as well. So I'm so excited for you, Tara, and a little bit jealous that you've gone through it and you'll be consecrated.
Your day will come.
I know. I just got to find the time in my calendar.
Yeah. And I think you've been to seminary, right? I think you're involved in some, historical understanding of the church. Yeah. So you'll have some of your classes under your belt already.
Sally, anything you want to add?
I just wanted to add kind of to the historical part. You know, many of the deaconesses back in the turn of the century helped to start what we now call our national mission institutions. And at one point we were over 100 of those across the U.S. Now we're down to just under 90 of them still in operation and providing ministry and outreach to their communities. But particularly many of them started as, our focus is on women, children, and youth. So a lot of them started as centers for early childhood learning or childcare to provide the women in those communities because they're predominantly in communities that we might say are marginalized. And so access to good childcare was hard for some women even that day and still today. And so I'm grateful that many of these national mission institutions are still in operation. And I try to visit if I'm going somewhere, whether it's personal fun or business, to stop and see if there's a national mission institution to visit it, because my heart is filled every time I do to see the children and the women who are taking advantage of the services that these centers provide. And some are residential homes where women transition. Others, like I said, are child care and multiple other services or medical care. And so they are great partners, not only with us, but within their community to the people they serve and other folks who can help provide services. And, you know, oftentimes that's a food pantry in addition to the services they provide to the women and children, but they also outreach to the entire community. So I am so proud that those national mission institutions show up every single day. And I have to admit that it's been difficult for them because so much of their funding has been cut. Many of them depended upon, federal grants or dollars to provide their services, but they're finding way and God's providing in this gap time to make sure that the ministry continues.
Thank you, Sally. And if someone were to want to visit one of those centers, is there like a website we can go to find where they are as we're traveling around?
Yes, if you go to uwfaith.org and when you click on the menu and there's a drop down and it'll say what we do, you'll find national ministries. Or if you type in national ministries, there's a map and it lists every one of them by state or by name. So you can choose, some states have multiple ones or some conferences may have multiple sites. And then there's a few conferences that do not have one at all, but there's likely one somewhere in a few hours distance from them.
Yeah, awesome.
And our women, I'm so proud of them because they show up, They serve on their boards. They help them, you know, serve as volunteers to make sure that that really is how I got really engaged with the United Women in Faith through an NMI in the Dallas area and providing volunteering at that site and just being part of that community, which some of my family had lived in for many years. And it was just a great connector.
Wow. So one of the things also that Dr. Blue talked about in our last episode is kind of how these women's organizations that were kind of existing outside of the church and then at other times existing within the structure of the church, they've almost had to constantly argue for their own authority or autonomy over their own organization, their own funds and things like that. And so I know that for a while in 1939, various women's organization groups from the Methodist Episcopal Church, the Methodist Episcopal Church South, and the Methodist Protestants merged to form the Women's Division. So can y'all kind of trace some of that history from the Women's Division to United Women in Faith? And is United Women in Faith autonomous today?
Yeah, so from the Women's Division, we were still under the oversight of the Board of Missions. And then when the merger happened, fast forward to 68-72 with the Evangelical United Brethren. So they had a women's organization and we had a women's organization, we being the Methodist Episcopal Church. And so when that uniting of the two denominations came, then we became the Women's Division and United Methodist Women, the United to bring in our connection to the Evangelical United Brethren Church, and then the Methodists, of which we were all becoming a part of as United. So that United has hung with us for a long time. And at that point, we were under the oversight, became the Women's Division under the General Board of Global Ministries. And that lasted up until 2012. And our board voted to become independent of Global Ministries. So we're not autonomous from the United Methodist Church. We're still a vital ministry and partner of the United Methodist Church, but we have our own agency at that point. And in 2022, we went through a rebranding and preparation. You know, around 2018, 2019, there was conversation starting to rise about there was going to be this big separation of the church. Disaffiliation wasn't the language at the time. So our board, you know, we had many conversations. We were already in the process of doing some rebranding. And our board said, you know, it is so important for us, whatever we do, to keep united as part of our name. Mm-hmm. And after going through different iterations and looking at names, we landed on United Women in Faith, because it is our faith that unites us. No matter, we've always been open to any woman that was interested in accepting our purpose in our ministry to women, children, and youth. So at that point, you know, United had to be still a part of the name. And it brought our heritage of the Evangelical United Brethren Church and our heritage as part of the United Methodist Church. So we're still front and center, part of the United Methodist Church, but just our own agency now.
And y'all have an event coming up. Do you want to tell us a little bit about not only this year's assembly, but, you know, why do you have assembly? What is its history?
I'll share a little of the history and then I'll let Tara chime in on the exciting year we've got of assembly this year. So it started in 1942 as a dream, I guess, to bring the members from the different connections together. Because we still had the Methodist Episcopal South, we still had the Methodist Episcopal. And so it was a way to bring the women, the members together, to be in fellowship with one another. And that historic one in 1942 was met with some challenge because it was scheduled to be in St. Louis, but St. Louis wouldn't allow the diversity of women in terms of race to particularly Black women to stay in their hotels. And I don't know how they did it. Praise God, they did. But they were bold enough to say, well, we choose to spend our money where all of our sisters can be together. And so I don't know. I haven't looked back historically at the months in which they had to make that decision, but they did and moved it to Columbus, Ohio. And so from that day forward, every 4 years, we come together in what's still called assembly for these wonderful times of worship together, plenary sessions, great speakers, town halls, panel discussions, workshops, and other networking opportunities for the members. So we are excited that this is the year of assembly 2026. Tara, you want to share a little bit about this year's?
In Indianapolis, Indiana, it is a big event thrown by the Women's Organization of the Church, but open to anyone who wants to come and do those things Sally was talking about, to network, to worship together, right, with people from around the world, hopefully as many as possible, right, and across the country. And so we celebrate what it means to be, you know, people who are faith-driven and want to transform the world in a positive way and make disciples of Christ. We have workshops that are in many different categories. You can have a body movement one. You can maybe learn about what it means to have some vitality, some Wesleyan vitality. You could take a workshop on how to run for general conference. I'm going to plug my own workshop, right? It's many different varieties of workshops, and we have town halls. We'll have an experience hall that has videos where you can sit and relax and watch some of the different programs and stories of United Women in Faith. You can visit all of the other agencies and some of those national mission institutions that Sally was talking about. I hear there's going to be 6 new historical cutouts at the archives and history booth. So you can't miss that, right? And if all of that didn't sell you, we have Bishop Tracy Malone speaking. We'll have Stephanie York Arnold, who is the General Secretary of the Commission on the Status and Role of Women, who will be our theologian in residence for the week. So you'll get to hear from her multiple times. And there's someone you may have heard of. Her name is Stacey Abrams. She said yes, and she's going to be our keynote speaker. And with her will be her mother, Reverend Carolyn Abrams, who is a United Methodist ordained elder. She's retired, but she's willing to come join us, and just the wisdom they'll be able to share with us. We have Liz Theo Harris, who is with the Poor People's Campaign. So that's a pretty big deal. We have some other women joining us from other denominations too, to make sure we're coming together as women in this moment in time. It's just a really great place to just be together and find some of that spirit you get from a mountaintop experience, right? But while we're on that mountaintop together in Indianapolis, May 15th to 17th, we'll also be getting those tools and making those connections that help us take it back out into the world. This only happens every 4 years, this event. And even though I work at it, right, I'm a staff of United Women in Faith and I'm very busy, I go home inspired. So imagine just getting to attend it, right? If I can go home and call it a mountaintop experience and feel renewed in my faith and my work, we would love for as many people as possible to come join us. You are welcome. Even if you don't identify as a woman, we have space for you as well, because, you know, we need all the support we can get and the work we're doing together. But if you do identify as a woman, this is a really great place to just find that sisterhood, be connected with women across our church and across denominations this year. We were intentional about just letting women know we're not isolated. We are together. We have work to do that can only be accomplished together in this particular moment in time. Yeah, assembly's great. I love assembly. We get all the women. Bishops will come and serve you communion, right? We dance together. One of my favorite photos from the 2022 assembly is the women bishops. We didn't have them working. They just came and joined worship and they were dancing together. And I think of that often to carry me through some of the harder times we're facing. But yes, assembly, Indianapolis, May 15th to 17th.
I'm glad that you're going to be joining us as well and offering a workshop. So thank you.
I'm very excited to come. 2022 was my first assembly, and you're right. Like it was an inspirational event. And so I'm glad to be offering a workshop. I'm really excited about our new cutouts.
Me too, clearly.
I've gotten the proofs today, and the one of Barbara Heck is holding flaming cards, and I'm just
Love oh it. My gosh.
Yeah.
That's worth the price right there.
Exactly. Right. So if you do come, make sure to come by the Archives and History booth and get a photo with all of the amazing women who grew and sustained the movement across our history. Tara and Sally, is there anything else that y'all want our listeners to know, either about Assembly or United Women in Faith?
Something Sally said about our national mission institutions. I'm going to go back to deaconesses for a minute. They would live together in community. They would literally go knock on doors and ask that community, what do you need? What do you need? We're here. And a lot of times it was the schools, right? It was a hospital. It was healthcare. They would listen to the community and answer those needs. And that's something our national mission institutions still do today. They carry on. And in fact, many deaconesses still work in those places. And as the community's needs change, so does the work of those national mission institutions. You come across deaconess in a hospital name, chances are you're connected to that work as a United Methodist and as the deaconess movement in our church. But like, what a great model for us today to, even if women aren't living together in the same way they once were as deaconesses, thankfully we have some more freedom of movement in today's day and age. But just to knock on doors and ask, what do you need? That's something I know local churches try to do, but it was quite literal. Hey, what do you need? What do you need from us? What can we do together to make this, you know, this community better, make this world better?
Well, I want to say, you know, the women have always been a movement. And from the very first time in 1869, what I still marvel at and share quite often when I speak is that, you know, they heard the missionary wives tell the story of how women in India were lacking medical attention and the girls and the women couldn't be educated. And within 6 months from that March 23rd, which is coming up on Monday, we'll be celebrating 157 years. But from that March gathering on that dark and stormy night in Boston, they, in 6 months, had raised enough money to send a woman doctor and educator to India. And, you know, the ministry still continues. So it's all about movement and seed planting and abiding in God to provide the growth and the nourishment. I quite often say our love language is definitely love, because I believe that love has guided us through these almost 157 years. And that's our superpower, and that God continues to provide the growth and to have us be strong in each generation. And so we're working hard to prepare for the next generation, 2029, when we'll be 160 years old. So that's 4 generations of us, and we'll expect to continue the same thing. So I just want to mention that we are planning for this movement to continue with a new membership campaign, which soft launched last year. But you'll see the big picture when we get to Assembly, because that's when the full launch will happen. And we're just encouraging members to invite new women to join us. And it's called Unstoppable, because the women, we are unstoppable. And so we're inviting all women, new women, whether you're in the Methodist Church or not, you do not have to be, as Tara said, but we're just welcoming all women who want to find a place of where they belong, where they can nurture their spirits, and where they can be empowered to lead, and where they can be empowered to go forth in the world and advocate for better situations than what might be existing in our communities today. So just want to invite women who may be listening to this to join us with the Unstoppable campaign.
Yes, thank you so much for continuing on this historic legacy and for actively creating history in this moment by continuing this and by, you know, still knocking on doors and asking folks the basic question of what do you need. To our listeners, if you want to register for Assembly, that is uwfaith.org/assembly. And we hope to see you there. All right, Tara and Sally, thank you so much for your time today. We really appreciate not only your time today, but the work that you do and the ministries that you still carry on.
Same to you. I'm a podcast fan.
Glad to be with you.
Yes, thanks, Ashley.
For the second half of today's episode, we are joined by Reverend Dr. Emily Nelms Chastain, who is a returning guest to Untied Methodism and is an assistant professor of Christian history and Methodist studies at Perkins School of Theology at Southern Methodist University. Her research focuses on American religious history, Methodist studies, and the history of women's ordination in American Protestantism, with a particular commitment to liberating forgotten voices from church basements, dusty archives, and the margins of denominational history where they have long waited. She's a deacon in full connection with the North Alabama Annual Conference of the United Methodist Church. Welcome, Emily, or welcome back, Emily.
Thanks for having me. I'm so excited to be here. Also, I would like to state for the record that GCAH is not a dusty archive of our denomination.
Thank you. Yes, our archives have no dust. Dust is very bad.
No.
So we've brought you on for the second part of this episode to talk about one of these women that kind of gets pushed to the margin, especially in Methodist history circles and stories. And yet, I think when you dig into her life, she kind of plays a really pivotal role in women eventually getting full ordination rights. So tell us about Madeline Southard.
So Madeline Southard is a Kansan, a very proud Kansan woman, who starts preaching and preaches for like a decade before she actually realizes that she's not allowed to preach in the Methodist Church. And, you know, she comes up in the progressive era in Kansas. And so, you know, she expects that everybody moves at the same rate as her home state, including in the Methodist realm. And so when she finds out that, you know, women can't preach, it's kind of a conundrum for her because she, like, she's been empowered by a church who called her. She's been empowered by a district superintendent who let her preach and gave her pulpits to preach in. I love her to death. She's so much fun. It's so much fun to read her journals and to kind of dig into her story. But she's a lifelong Methodist. She's raised by a single mother. She has a grandmother that she lives with for a long time. And her mother dies when she's fairly young. And a tornado comes through in Kansas and takes away her home. And so she's really like, it's her and her sister. And she knows she's called to preach. She doesn't hide it at all. She gets a little cohort of men folk who also know that she's called to preach and kind of support her while she's a student at what was Southwest Kansas College is now Southwestern College in Kansas. And she comes up in that Kansas area and just travels to lots of different states preaching the word. And then she realizes that the denomination doesn't call her to preach. And she decides she's going to change that and make sure that the General Conference recognizes women's calls to preach because she thinks it's a theological problem.
I mean, this is one of those stories that it stands out as a little different from the stories of other women that we've talked about so far, at least on this podcast series of, you know, before it was that women had calls and then kind of, I don't want to say sheepishly, but like kind of, you know, wiggled their way in to see if they're allowed to, or, you know, test the waters a little bit, but that's not the case here. No, she was a decade and like had a cohort of people, was being, as you said, right, like appointed or given pulpits. And then a decade later realizes, oh, wait, I wasn't supposed to be doing that, but I did that. And people showed up and no one threw stones.
Right? Yeah, yeah. She travels to General Conference in 1912 on her own volition just to see what it's about. And then she decides in 1920 to run as a lay woman. And she becomes the head of the delegation in 1920. So, like, people know who she is. She was part of the WCTU unit movement. So she fought for prohibition. In fact, got arrested a few times with Carrie Nation, and then the Women's Temperance, the WCTU came back and they're like, hey, you gotta calm that down. You can't run around with Carrie like this, like if you're going to be an employee of the WCTU.
Yeah, stop taking axes to liquor barrels.
Right. And,
you know, doing all the violent things that Carrie Nation so wonderfully did.
Right. So she's, you know, she's this really strong, independent woman. You know, I'm really just mesmerized by her courageousness, her tenacity. Or what is it that Bishop Williams did? Her gumption. Like, yeah. She's just kind of like, she knows what's right. She's going to do it. And she doesn't second guess herself. And so this woman is just absolutely fantastic. But she ends up going to General Conference in 1920. She's just graduated from Garrett Biblical Institute. So she got a master's at Garrett. She writes about Jesus's attitude towards women. And when she goes and gets elected in 1920, she sends this enormous packet of things to people, to every single delegate that she can find. And she sends them a copy of Frances Willard's Woman in the Pulpit. She sends them a copy of her thesis. She sends them a copy of Ministry and Vocation out of the Methodist Review and her petition. And then, like, without any fear, just goes and speaks up at the 1920 General Conference. And just is like, well, we've misinterpreted Paul, like, from the get-go. And comes in and says, you know, like, are we going to be the people, or other women are waiting for Methodism to make their decision about women preaching? And we've got to make this decision. Like, people are waiting. And calls out and says, you know, we don't want to be the church that everybody looks at and says, well, they kept misinterpreting Paul, so they got it wrong for so many times. And I mean, I still can't believe what she said in 1920. Like, yeah, in this wildly public space at the 1920 General Conference without fear.
Is it in 1912 when she just kind of wanders into General Conference? Is that when she learns that she's not allowed to preach? Or did she hear that and then go see if it's true for herself or something?
I think when she was in college at Southwestern, she learned from some of her professors that it was actually because she knew who Anna Howard Shaw was because of her suffrage work. And so she learns the story of Anna Howard Shaw and learns that Anna Howard Shaw was denied in 1880. Yeah. And so she knows that part of the story. And that's when she really kind of learns, like, oh, wait, I actually don't have the right to preach here. And it's not fair that, like, God called me, but I'm second class just because I'm a woman. Like, if God called me, like, who's anybody? I mean, this is a similar argument, right, to the Jerina Lees and the Sarah Crosbys, you know, where it's like, you know, God has called me. Who are you to say that God didn't? And so she really challenges that from, you know, about, I would say, like, she goes to Garrett to do her master's. And when she's really digging into scripture, she's really digging into this decision. And her book, it's a small book, right? So it's like a large pamphlet, small book, is talking about, like, to look at how Jesus treated women. Like, Jesus continually centered women in these conversations, and that men have always tried to find ways to other women in the presence of Jesus. And so her theological argument is coming right out of the fundamentalist modernist controversy, right, of the introduction of historical critical method. And so she runs with it, but she's running with it. She's extracting this theology from Leanna Starr's Bible Status of Women. She's building on Catherine Bushnell's God's Word to Women to write this master's thesis. And so when she's got this very strong modernist push, and she's got this strong theological argument that's built on these other women.
Yeah. And this is all happening against the social backdrop of, you know, in the 1910s, women were gaining access to the polls, the election polls, kind of state by state, if you will.
Yeah.
Right. And so I just always think it's so fascinating when the church and society are almost kind of in that lockstep. And so you know, the fact that she goes to the 1920 General Conference and it is a woman after my own heart handing out all of these master's theses to delegates who are probably like, what the, I'm not going to read this. But with this, like, well-crafted argument about why women should have more authority or more say in the general levels of the church.
And legitimacy, right? Yeah. Like, this, she's asking them to legitimate the call of women preachers for all of history, because the denomination has continually closed it off. And not not accidentally, right? So we're talking about like an intentional patriarchy that has closed off this argument for decades, that they said, no, we can't actually envision a world where like women may be called to preach, but they don't belong in a pulpit. And so there is a constructed patriarchy that she's addressing, and she's asking for not just women to preach, right? She's asking for ecclesiastical equality. Like that's Ooh. The title of her petition that goes forward. And so, you know, when she gets up then to speak and talk about how the church has continually misinterpreted scripture and has taken away the rights of women, she's speaking light years ahead of where we can even speak today, right? Like a lot of us have never stood at General Conference to say these kind of things even into today.
Wow. And I'm assuming that that petition does not pass, since we aren't celebrating 100 and I'm not going to pretend to do the math.
Yeah, we don't do math well as historians.
I know.
That would be too powerful. it partially passes. So in 1920, okay. The denomination gives back local ordination or licensing as we know it, right? So they get a license and then they say, okay, like we get it. Women called to preach, like we're fine with that. However, we cannot give women full ordination because not only would it give them a right to vote in annual conferences, it would give them a guaranteed appointment. Mm. And they're like, absolutely not. Like we cannot guarantee because, you know, women, they get married, they have babies, they have like they put all of these obstacles up as reasons that, you know, they shouldn't put this forward, including at one point they even discussed in like the 1930s, like, well, maybe we can give it to unmarried women, but then you lose it when you get married. Like if you choose to get married, then, you know, ordination is off. So they win the local ordination piece.
Okay.
But it gets tabled, right? So yeah. They table it to 1924. Mm-hmm. And so then Madeline Southard, being the incredible woman that she is, like sniffs this out for the next 4 years. And she's trying to find the list of who's on this commission that's been designated, who's in charge, all this stuff. It's like 3 years before she finds out who is in charge of this commission that's supposed to be meeting over this 4-year study. She finds the bishop that is leading it. And she goes to meet with this bishop twice. And the bishop is pretty like, he's not really optimistic about the potential of this. And so he tells Madeline, like, yeah, I just don't know how it's going to go. We don't have a lot of good data. So then she turns around into this and she builds this organization on the side in 1919 called the Association of Women Preachers. And she goes to their newspaper and starts distributing news articles to say, we need this data. Here's where you send it. Like she gave them the address of the person who's like collecting all this data. So she basically doxes the committee, right? And like says, all right, here's where you send it. I need all you Congregationalist women, especially, to be sending it their way. So they amass all this data, but then she arrives to the 1924 General Conference to find out that the bishop that was in charge has fallen gravely ill. He actually dies right after General Conference. So he's not at General Conference. And they've appointed some person that she didn't know to like give the report. And so the person comes up to give the report and she acknowledges this is why the 1912 visit pays off in such big ways. 1912, 1920 pay off for her in significant ways because she's like, whoa, 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 whoa. We cannot talk about this when it hasn't been printed. Like the legislation is not like the report is not in the Daily Christian Advocate. Like we can't talk about this. And she's running like from the back of General Conference, like a mad woman. There's a whole article that comes out and says that she was crazy and shook her fist in the face of the bishops because she's like, we cannot vote on this when we haven't even seen the report. Like, what did they report? So she connects with the commission person. They manage to get it reported the next day. It goes into a committee. Of course, they recommend non-concurrence, right? And so 1924 starts this cycle that lasts every single General Conference from 1924 up until 1956. There's at least one petition that comes up every year or every quadrennium to talk about this. But starting in the mid 30s, they start getting more and more and more. And so like 1938, there's like 30 something, when the year before there were like seven. And then in 1938, she writes in the woman's pulpit, she's like, you know, it would be so great if we could get like 1,000 petitions about this. And then in 1956, what happens? They get 2,000.
Wow.
So they amass, like, over that whole like long period, the Association of Women Preachers are still doing the work. They now have brought in Georgia Harkness into this work. Georgia Harkness is writing for them, writing other articles, teaching in theology about how this is an equitable theology. And they push through, even through the merger, where the Methodist Protestant women lose their rights when they merge as the Methodist Church. Mm-hmm. And they keep pushing and they keep chipping and they keep chipping. And so, you know, this is what, from 1920 to 1956, 36 years that this association has been on this every quadrennium, and even longer, right? That women have been waiting. So yeah, she's quite a character.
It sounds like it. Was 1924 her last general conference, or did she, no, was she serving through 56?
It's the last time that she serves as a delegate. But okay. It's not the last time she goes. She ends up actually going into the mission field. And so she goes to, I believe it's the 1928 General Conference, and she knows she's about to depart. She is bound for India, but she goes into the Philippines on the way. And when she gets into the Philippines, she's basically starting a lot of the work that the Board of Women's Work does now in the Philippines, where she starts identifying human trafficking and bringing it up, especially for women who are being trafficked. And she starts bringing it up to the government authorities in the Philippines, because she understands, she finds out that it's the American military that are actually like trafficking these young women into the Philippines just for their own pleasure. And so, but her time in the Philippines becomes limited, and she goes to India and she meets with E. Stanley Jones and spends time with him there. But she makes it back by the 1932 General Conference, and she shows up there. She's at all of these general conferences because she's got this work with the Association of Women Preachers. She's connecting with all of these missionary pals that she met along the way. So she's quite a woman.
So did she live to see women receive full ecclesial equality, or whatever she ecclesiastically?
Ecclesiastical equality. She does. She died in 1967. So she was not present in 1956, but she did get to celebrate it through her organization, the Association of Women Preachers. She wrote for that thing all the way up through the early 1960s. And they celebrated her work because she just had this tenacity. So she would not quit. And it is so remarkable to just see her continue to push through regardless of those decisions. I mean, obviously she pours some of that grief into her journals and she gets frustrated by a lot of it, but you know, she's so committed to this that like nobody's going to take that joy away from her. So she celebrates from her retirement in Kansas. And then of course, Georgia Harkness gets to celebrate it in person in 1956. And so it's this reminder, like Madeline Southard is this reminder, her and Georgia Harkness, that like the work of 1956 is like, it's not this epiphany. It's not when all the men finally were like, oh, this is a great idea, right? This is where the continued intentional paperwork pays off into Pentecost. It's just a reminder, especially when you start tracking how many years they've been doing this same cycle of paperwork, and she learns how to make it efficient, and so much that the petitions increase every single year, that there were 2,000 petitions is more than multiple of those general conferences had in total. But for one issue in 1956, there are 2,000 petitions that
are. That's amazing. So Emily, how did you first learn about Madeline?
You know, I grew up in a different denomination and was called into ministry and found the Methodist Church, thankfully, because they supported women in ministry. And so I was so impressed with this history. And when I did my Master of Divinity and Master in Religious Studies when I was at Claremont. I got familiar with the name, and I came across her in Paul Chilcote's book about the Methodist Defense for Women in Ministry. And he had the petition text that was in there, and I just thought that was really fascinating. So when I got to my PhD program at Boston University, I was taking a class in American liberalism, and we were talking about the modernist fundamentalist debate. And I was reading some things from Margaret Bindroth about the arguments about gender. And so I came across Madeline Southard, and I found out that her journals were actually in Boston. And so I raced across the river. Well, they actually weren't in Boston. They were in Cambridge. So I raced across the river to go and look at some of these and discover this entire organization that she built to help construct this narrative, not just for Methodists, right? The Methodists were her guinea pigs. They were her trial and error. And so she replicates the same thing for the Presbyterian Church in the United States. They end up joining into the fight later on for the Episcopal Church in the United States in the 1970s. They join in with the women's ordination movement in the Catholic Church. They have an annual report that comes out on the ecclesiastical status of women, not just in the United States. They track them across the world. So you've got these denominations that are changing their polity throughout history, and they're tracking every single one of them every year. And it's just, it's incredible because she understands, right? Like, this is not, it's not just this movement that's important for me as a Methodist. Yes, she got her license, right? But when she didn't get fully ordained because she was already retired at that point, but it didn't just matter for her, right? She was like, I'm going to make sure that this matters for all women who feel called, so that their calls are legitimized by the church. And not just that, but they're now acquiring not just a permissive theology toward women, but like, this is our theology. Like, this is our foundation that all people who are called are going to be in, are going to be allowed to be in ministry. And so, I mean, this is a starting point where we start to accept more people of color into ministry, the LGBTQ folks. Like, this is the starting point, right? Where you change the theology, and they systematically change it through the discipline, right? That like, this means that this is now open for all people.
Wow. Are there any critical biographies of Madeline? Or if our listeners wanted to learn more about her, where would you recommend they go?
There's not a full biography, but you can find a few articles about her by Kendra Irons that got published in Methodist History Journal. And then Kendra wrote a book about Kansas women preachers that she's in. Madeline Southard also shows up in Kristen Cobes-Dumais' dissertation. So she also wrote about some of these Kansan women that were pistols from the start. So, and then of course, I'm working on transitioning my dissertation into a book, and we'll be talking about her work in the Methodist Church and how it impacts all of women's ordination in American Protestantism.
Wow. Wow. Well, Emily, thank you for your wisdom and your expertise and for sharing the story of Madeline Southard with us. She's, you know, we have this growing list so far, 3-4 months into this podcast series, of women that, you know, we really kind of need some critical bios of, and that are just amazing, and you know, whose shoulders we stand on top of. So thank you for joining us. And I know that we're going to be back with you for another episode, if not two.
Yeah.
No, this is your area of expertise.
Yeah, I love getting to talk about this. And so I'm so grateful that you had me on and have had me on in the past to also talk about women in Methodism. And so it is definitely a bright spot in my research.
Awesome. Well, until our next conversation, Emily, thank you.
Thank you.
To our listeners who are joining us, we will see you next time. Thank y'all.